This is the Afternoon Magazine, and I'm Amy Guida, legal issues and the news commentator, sitting in for Celeste Quinn. This is the last Friday of the month, a monthly look at a legal topic. Today, a focus on thoughts, the law, and the internet. With me today is Lawrence Lessig, author of a book titled The Future of Ideas. He's a law professor at Stanford and founder of the school's Center for Internet and Society. Newsweek calls him a cyber law pioneer, and Business Week named him as one of the 25 most influential people in electronic business. His new book, The Future of Ideas, The Fate of the Commons in a Connected World, is published by Random House. Hello, Professor Lessig.
Hello.
And you're welcome to call in with questions or comments. The number is 333-9455 from Champaign-Urbana, or from anywhere else, call us toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL and 1-800-222-WILL. What's your thesis here, Professor Lessig?
Well, in this book, I describe a picture of the internet as it first came to us, a space that built a neutral platform that lots of people could innovate and create on top of. And then the dark part of the story is how that initial neutral platform is being corrupted, both by people who have control over lots of copyright and also people who are building the infrastructure, in a way that will destroy this opportunity for innovation and creativity that defined the original internet. So it's a dark story of how something that offered great promise to our culture and to creators, both commercial and non-commercial, is going to become something much less promising.
When did you first recognize a problem? Was there an aha moment for you somewhere along the line?
Well, I'm a lawyer first, and so lawyers don't know typically much about technology, but I've been playing with technology for a long time. And when I began to look at how the network was built, you know, right at the level of its architecture, it became clear to me from reading all these architects' description of why the network was special that it was special for a very particular technical reason, and that technical reason didn't necessarily have to survive as the internet went through different generations of evolution, so that the technology of the internet could change. And if that technology changed, if this kind of architectural design changed, then what made the internet originally special would change as well. And so what I found was technologists didn't think much about policy. They just write the code. Policymakers didn't know anything about the technology. That's too geeky for them. And this gap between technologists and policymakers meant that nobody really recognized what you could think of as an environmental impact from the change of this underlying technology, environmental impact for creativity and innovation. And so that's really what got me going and writing about this.
And before we go there, can you give us a brief history of copyright then? Because that's what we talk about eventually. Mm-hmm. When did copyright start?
Well, copyright in the United States is set up by our Constitution, which gives Congress the power to give exclusive rights to authors for limited times. And the framers had a very limited conception of what copyright would be, because their original statute gave authors of books, maps, and charts 14 years protection if they registered their work. They could renew that once, so a maximum of 28 years protection. And protection against republication. So it's basically a very limited regulation of publishers. Now, in the 212-odd years since that initial statute, copyright law in the United States has grown dramatically. Mm-hmm. It's grown not only in what it covers, so it covers basically all creative acts reduced to tangible form, but also in the kind of rights that it grants and also in the duration of those rights. So it covers now just not just a republication of an original copyrighted work, but translations or adaptations or setting the words to song or making a movie out of it. All of the derivative works are also controlled. And they're controlled not for a term of 14 years, but for the life of the author plus 70 years, which for the works of somebody like Irving Berlin would mean a protection of 140 years. And the worst part about that change is that this change is not just prospectively. You know, it's not like just as if Congress has said, okay, from now on, copyright will be longer. But for the last 40 years, Congress has gotten into this addiction to the idea of extending the term of existing copyrights. So copyright has been extended in the last 40 years 11 times for existing works. Some of us call this the Mickey Mouse Protection Act, which is every time Mickey Mouse is about to fall into the public domain, Congress extends the term of copyright. And the perversity of this is that copyright was designed to create incentives for people to produce something new. The one thing we know about incentives is that you can't incent backwards. No matter what we do, Hawthorne is not going to produce any new work. So when Congress extends the term of existing copyrights, it's not doing anything to create new incentives. All it's doing is giving a windfall to existing copyright holders, and primarily to these large corporations who spend a great deal of money lobbying Congress to extend their copyright.
So give listeners an idea of what you mean. What's your greatest horror story that proves that this concern of yours is a real problem?
Well, the book talks about corruption coming from two sides. One is corruption at what we can think of as the network layer, the physical construction of the Internet. And another is the corruption coming from a content layer, or what we were just talking about here with copyright law. At the physical layer, the nightmare is that as the network moves into broadband, which is fast, always-on network connection, it's moved from the telephone lines onto cable lines. And as the cable companies have begun to offer Internet service, they're not living by the rules that governs the original Internet. So what that means is, rather than building a network where the network owners have no control over what content and applications happen on the network, the new network owners are increasingly exercising control over the type of content and applications that run on the network. And the problem with that is that the innovators then, both content and applications, now need to, in some sense, negotiate with the network owners before their new innovations run. So there's something called policy-based routers, which cable companies are deploying, which would give the cable company the power to say, these websites flow quickly or come to the our customers quickly, and these websites come slowly, or these applications are allowed and those applications are not. And what that means is that the cable companies now become the bottleneck in deciding which innovations will be allowed. And obviously, since they have certain interests, like protecting their video market against new competition, they will tilt the market against innovation which doesn't benefit them. So that's one dimension of what the dark side of this future is. Mm-hmm. And that is that it's not users or customers or people who develop for the Internet that choose what its future looks like. It's increasingly the network owners, and that will fundamentally change the way the network develops.
We're talking with cyber law pioneer Lawrence Lessig, Stanford law professor, author of The Future of Ideas, and we welcome your calls, 333-9455 from Champaign-Urbana or 1-800-222-9455, toll-free from anywhere else. One of the stories I was reading about involved Sony's robotic dog.
Right.
Do you know anything about that story?
Right. So Sony has this wonderful little pet called the Aibo, and the Aibo is this mechanical or robotic dog which actually learns how to behave and in its interaction with its owner. Obviously, this dog is run by a computer, and the computer has software in it. And a number of people started tinkering with their Aibo dog, a dog which they've purchased from Sony, to figure out how they might change that software to make it so that the software made the dog do something different. So one person developed software to make the Aibo dog dance jazz and posted that software on his website. Now, we live in a legal regime which has become extraordinarily strict about tinkering with other people's code. If you tinker with people's code or interfere with control of their copyrighted material, you have very likely have committed a crime. even if you are tinkering, is for completely harmless fair use reasons, such as what this guy would have done with his dog dancing jazz. So when he posted his tinker with Sony's code on his website, the Sony lawyers instantly contacted him and told him that he was violating these rules that said that you're not allowed to tinker with software that Sony owns, and threatened legal action if he didn't stop attempting to exercise control over his Aibo dog. Now, this is a great example of how, you know, this copyright regime has gotten out of control, because there's no legitimate interest that Sony would have to stop what somebody does with their Aibo dog in their own home, or stop people tinkering and sharing the information about how to, you know, make their dog do something different with other people. You know, it's like Ford saying that it's a crime to open up the hood of your Ford Mustang and tinker with the carburetor to make it be more efficient, and telling other people about how to make the carburetor function differently.
But how about this argument? How about if someone programmed their Aibo dog to go out on the street and do something annoying to passersby? Can't you put yourself in Sony's shoes then and say that would then harm our business reputation, and that's what we're trying to protect? We don't want to open the floodgates here.
Well, I can understand why Sony wants to protect their reputation. I can understand why Sony wants to exercise control over everything that I do with the Aibo dog. But just because Sony wants to exercise that kind of control, it doesn't follow that it's good policy to allow corporations to exercise the control over what we do with our with stuff that we've purchased from them. There's lots of examples, for example, of software companies that put in the license of their software a requirement that says you can't criticize our software in public or on web pages. So if you've got a problem with our software, you're not allowed to post a complaint on a public web page that says this software is terrible because of the following six things about it.
Now, do you feel this same way about music, though? People who take music off the internet and tweak it around a bit? There we're talking about an individual, sort of a, I guess, a corporate individual, Britney Spears, for example. Do you feel the same way, that Britney Spears has no interest in protecting her music, her artistic expression?
No, I think artists, and I think Sony too, has a legitimate interest in protecting their expression against copyright violations, right? So Sony certainly has an interest in stopping somebody from stealing the code that makes the Aibo dog run, and then building their own Aibo dog and then selling it for much cheaper because they didn't have to develop the software that makes the Aibo run. I mean, that's a copyright violation, and I think that's should be prosecuted and stopped. Same thing with people who would take, for whatever reason, Britney Spears' music and distribute it in a way that competes directly with the, with her ability to make money off of her music. I don't support the idea of copyright violations, but it's a different question whether you, there's two separate issues here. One, should people be allowed to violate copyright law? Simple answer: no. Second, how broadly should copyright law give copyright owners the power to control what happens to their content? And my point is, our tradition has always been a tradition of balance. And increasingly, the Hollywood and recording industry has succeeded in convincing the world that balance is somehow corrupt or criminal. Instead, we ought to have perfect control granted to the copyright holders. Now, it's that extremism that I think is going to lead to a chill on innovation and creativity. Because if you give Hollywood or the recording industry the keys to our future is going to look a lot less interesting than what it would if it were, as our tradition has always left it, free to innovators to create and develop new ideas.
And we have a caller on line one, Champaign County. Are you there?
Yeah. Yes. I have a couple of things, and I don't know, that I was thinking maybe they were kind of well, one of them's particularly germane, but the other one's not so much. But once you started talking about Sony's dog, I thought I'd have to call up and say that I'm shocked you can't teach a Sony dog new tricks. But And perhaps maybe chasing cars down the street, as the image I had when you were on that lineup. What I wanted to ask you about, and it may have come about after your book went to print, but you may have something on it, and I'm not sure I'm getting the right corporate players down, but I know Microsoft's involved, and I think they have a deal with Comcast, which is a big, fairly big cable unit, and as we know, Microsoft's always for entrenching their own standards, no matter how good or bad they are. They want their own on the net, and it seems like that's a particularly likely place. Do you have anything current on that?
That's a great question, because people are very fearful of Microsoft exercising their power over the operating system and their power over affiliated companies, Comcast might be one of them, in order to control the future of innovation and development in the context of the Internet. And if Microsoft did that, it's exactly the kind of problem that I'm talking about in the book. Now, when I wrote the book, Microsoft was not attempting to be a big player in the cable area. The more obvious example of this would be America Online. You know, think about America Online, which now, when it's after its merger with Time Warner, is merged with the largest holder of copyrights in the world, that's Time Warner. America Online controls almost half of the access to the Internet through their particular software. So at the code layer of the Internet, they have fundamental control. And after their merger with Time Warner, they owned a great number of cable companies as well. And these cable companies are increasingly providing access to the Internet through their cable lines. So they own all three layers of the network in some sense. And that creates a great temptation for them to attempt to integrate across these three layers in a way that chills other competitors. Now, I've gotten in a lot of trouble from people who are opponents to Microsoft because, in fact, I think Microsoft has a strategy that, depending on how it's developed, could resist this kind of corruption. Because .NET, I'm not promising this is the way it's going to be developed, and I'm not saying it's the only way to develop it, but .NET at least has a picture of what the future network would be that would resist the idea that cable companies could muck about with network, or that people in the middle would exercise control over what happens to the network. Their new strategy, .NET, really depends upon the Internet being as the Internet originally was. So while I do think that there's good reason to be skeptical about Microsoft, and certainly they were found unanimously to have violated the antitrust laws by the Court of Appeals in the D.C. Circuit, I actually think the there's at least a way Microsoft could be a great defender of the best values of the Internet in the future. And other companies that have been more benign in the past, such as America Online, might increasingly become the target of our concern.
Well, I'm not hopeful on that point, as you might guess. But and .NET is all about entrenching standards, I think, to some extent. So
That's true. Mm-hmm. But the real question is whether they allow these standards to remain open the way they say they will. Now, they have the potential to close them up because they own lots of patents that are core to their technology, and they could begin to exercise those patents against competitors. And if they do that, then I think that that's a corruption in exactly the sense I'm talking about in the book. But if they don't, .NET, with its embrace of what it calls web services, could facilitate pressure to keep the network honest. And, you know, that's what I'm hopeful for, although I agree with you, there's good reason to be skeptical.
This isn't the other point. This is a follow-on to this point, which is that the theory is that DSL and phone line competition with broadband is supposed to counterbalance the cable company somewhat. And we have a situation in Illinois, and I think it's much more regional than that because this is San Antonio-based SBC that bought Ameritech here. But we have, in this community, have DSL available. But because of a contretemps between the state regulatory body, and I forget which one it is, and SBC, they're not spreading that at all. So right now the cable, and I think that's true of a number of other states, so...
Yeah,
they're a bigger player, and you think they want to get in, but apparently they want to get in on only their own terms.
Right, mm-hmm. And this is a problem that's all over the country. I mean, you know, what's extraordinary about broadband in the United States is that here we have cable companies and telecoms that have been extraordinarily slow in rolling out broadband, and they've complained and they've whined about all sorts of things that make it, quote, too difficult to roll out broadband. Yet other countries like South Korea and Canada have far outstripped the United States in the deployment of broadband, much greater penetration at a lower price. Now, the reason for this is that competition doesn't exist when you have two competitors. That's duopoly. That's not competition. And both of these actors, the cable companies and the telecoms, want a world where they're permitted to exercise the kind of discrimination over content and applications that cable companies have always exercised. They want not the internet, they want cable television on speed. And it's that that vision of the future that they have, which is really, I think, slowing innovation in the context of the internet. And it's the failure of the government to actually push this competition, which has resulted in us falling behind South Korea and Canada in broadband deployment for no good reason. Now, this is not going to get any better because Washington is now ruled by an ideology that says the best strategy for the future is to let these cable companies do whatever they want. They want to build an internet that doesn't run everything equally or neutrally. That's fine because they need the incentive to build these new wires. Well, that ideology, which is just what it is, it's an ideology, will not produce the internet. It's not what was responsible for the internet. It will produce a network which is increasingly balkanized, and that balkanization will stifle innovation and creativity.
We're talking with cyber law pioneer Lawrence Lessig, Stanford law professor, author of The Future of Ideas. You can call us 333-9455 from Champaign-Urbana, 1-800-222-9455 from anywhere else. We have a call on line two from Urbana.
Yeah, I had two questions. First, I really agree with the thrust of what you're saying, sir. And one of the first questions is kind of related to that. I was just wondering if there are still people in Silicon Valley who remember the old days even, and who wondering how your message is being received there. And if not there, where are you getting the most support?
Hmm. Well, there certainly are people who get this and understand it and agree. And they are typically coders, people who write the software that makes this system run. They're the people who originally architected the network to support this kind of freedom and creativity. And they see exactly how it's being corrupted. Unfortunately, it's being corrupted partly by the very same people who built it, because they're now hired by corporations whose interest is not the picture of this neutral platform for innovation, but who want to build a network that that benefits the corporate owners. So they get it. Silicon Valley sort of gets it, but the truth is Silicon Valley and these technologists generally are pathetically apolitical about attempting to get their message out to show Washington what Washington needs to do to assure the continued innovation and creativity that the original internet produced. And the second problem with it is that there are so many confusing corporate interests that have now taken over in Silicon Valley that even when Silicon Valley speaks, it's not clear that the message that's coming through is a message about restoring the environment of innovation as much as a message about benefiting some particularly strong actors at the expense of innovation generally. So people get it, but there's no good movement to make sure that Washington gets it. And instead, Washington is ruled by this completely false ideology about what made the internet function originally and what will make it grow in the future.
Well, I really don't think their ideas have much to do with that as much as they just see dollar signs and they can't figure out a way. Every place they look, they try to find ways to make the cash registers ring, and that's about all they see. But my last question, I'll hang up after I ask it, is you talk about the way the cable systems are being able to exclude people or have their websites come up slowly, that kind of thing. But I haven't. I understand, or you haven't mentioned browsers currently do pretty much the same thing, and I was wondering if you could speak to that a little bit, the way that say Yahoo or Google, you know, excludes a lot of the alternative or marginal sites in favor of you know, something more a lowest common denominator. And I'll hang up. Thank you.
Well, there have been a lot of allegations about search engines that say that search engines play a similar game so that you can buy higher rankings on some search engines just by paying the search engine to rank your stuff higher. But I'm less concerned about that in the context of web portals and search engines because there's still very strong competition in that context. So if you begin to learn that one search engine is biasing its results in favor of those who pay as opposed to those sites that are most relevant to your content, it's very easy just to pick a different search engine. And Google, for example, my understanding is, doesn't play these games at all, instead has a very innovative and creative way of identifying relevant content. And I now find Google to be, you know, extraordinarily good in picking out exactly what I'm looking for. Partly, I think, because it doesn't allow itself to get corrupted by this kind of game. So the point is, the point I'm making is not that we need to be worried every time business is interested in trying to find a way to make a dollar. My concern is when business exercises its control in places that we don't have a competitive system vibrant enough to resist it. And that's increasingly what's true about broadband, because there isn't a sufficient competition between cable companies or between cable and other ways of getting access to the Internet to make sure that they don't play these games to benefit themselves against other kinds of innovation. And it's in those contexts where there's a proper role for government. But we live in a time where people think government has no role at all and should have no role at all, and it's because of that ideology that the consequences that I'm talking about will come about.
And we have another caller on line 3 from Champaign. Are you there?
Yes. Good afternoon. Well, this is a great show. I was just wondering if the caller could comment on what he thinks is might be the situation. To what extent does the lag in the ability and knowledge of people who rule on law and jurisprudence, et cetera, with regards to technology, that would affect sort of helpful legislation or at least protection against the kind of situation we seem to be heading for? I mean, I think you could make a case that even as far back as the 80s when Microsoft clearly stole Apple's idea for the PC, basically, it didn't seem to me that the legal profession or the judiciary or whatever you want to, however you want to term it, was really up to speed on the issues and the technology, which was the context of what they were ruling upon. And the speed at which technology changes is so amazing that the vast majority of us can't keep up. And I would imagine the same would be true for the judges. So, you know, to what extent does that influence a lot of these areas? Because, I mean, Microsoft, you know, they dominate pretty much all areas of technology now, and it's just getting worse. And the last ruling, which seems like it's going to go nowhere, is a good case in point. Now they have the pockets to even buy all of the politicians in case people are up to speed. So it seems like that it's a big problem. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Well, it's certainly true that judges are not up to speed about the technology. But what's hopeful is that judges pretty much know they're not up to speed, and sometimes they use this knowledge to inspire a kind of humility when they deal with these issues, and sometimes they forget the humility and they just act in the face of their ignorance in a way which is really quite destructive to the technology. So consider the difference between two cases. One is the context of Congress's attempts to regulate the distribution of porn on the Internet. And the second case is the case of Congress's attempts to regulate the distribution of copyrighted material on the Internet. Now, when it comes to porn, the Supreme Court and lower courts have been very careful to lecture Congress. Congress has to make sure that when it's protecting children, It does not protect children. It does not regulate in a way that harms the rest of the Internet. So the Supreme Court has said it's a compelling state interest to make it so that children are protected from pornography in cyberspace. But in that protecting, we have to make sure that the regulation does not create too great a burden on the rest of cyberspace. And the reason for this hesitancy was the court's self-conscious recognition that it didn't understand this enough, and that we didn't—that it didn't want its rulings to lead to the harm of much of cyberspace. Now, contrast that in the context of copyright regulation. Here, once again, you have lots of new regulation, which is directly affecting how the Internet develops. But in the context of copyright legislation, the courts are not saying, well, Congress, you have to go slowly, or you have to target your regulations narrowly to make sure that they don't harm the rest of the Internet. Here, in the context of copyright, the courts have been extremely quick to shut down any technology which copyright owners say violates their copyrights. Now, what explains this difference in attitude is bizarre to me, because if you think about it, you know, if just an ordinary person looks at it and says, between protecting children and protecting Hollywood, which should our courts be more concerned to do? And I think most people would say protecting children is the more important interest here, not protecting Hollywood. So if any place we should say, well, let's go slowly in regulating cyberspace and let's make sure that we don't harm the rest of cyberspace, you would think it's in the context of copyright, not in the context of porn. But in fact, our courts have been exactly reversed. And I personally don't understand why this is, but that's the reality. Now, you mentioned this issue about Microsoft stealing Apple's idea for a Windows environment. Now, I'm a huge Apple fan. I've been ever since I clerked for Judge Richard Posner in the Seventh Circuit, and he forced me to use a Apple Macintosh. I've fallen in love with the operating system. But in fact, I think it's a great thing that Microsoft was allowed to, quote, steal Apple's idea for Windows operating system. Just like I think it was a great thing that Apple was able to steal the idea from Xerox in the first place. I'm not a strong supporter of overly protective copyright and patent regimes that would make it hard for subsequent innovators to build on earlier innovators' work. I was a critic of the early versions of Windows, but I have a machine on my desk now that has Windows XP. I think Windows XP has lots of great functionality, and the competition between Windows and Microsoft and Apple Macintosh has produced better operating systems on both platforms. Now, I agree with you. Microsoft has a dominant position here. I don't think it has a dominant position because it stole the Windows operating system. I think it has a dominant position in part because it violated the antitrust laws. And it violated the antitrust laws not because of its stealing of anything Apple did, but because of its behavior with respect to new technologies such as browsers and Java, which the Court of Appeals found threatened Microsoft's monopoly and which Microsoft improperly defended itself against. So in that sense, I think you're right. Microsoft has gone too far. But I'm happy they succeeded in getting away with stealing Windows, because that's created lots of innovation for users generally.
Now, your book is copyrighted.
Right.
And you've said that copyright is a critical part of the creative process.
Right.
Where do we draw the line then? How much is just enough?
Right. So I've gotten lots of people, including Hillary Rosen of the recording industry, calling up on one of these radio call-in shows and saying, aren't I being hypocritical? Shouldn't I be giving my book away if I want to criticize copyright law? And the answer is, the world is not divided into those who think we should have copyright and those who think we should have no copyright. Right? There is this position of balance that says some copyright is extremely important. You wouldn't get major movies made if there weren't copyright protection. Many authors wouldn't write their works if there were copyright protection. So I'm a strong supporter of copyright law. But it has to be balanced. And the criticism I've been making is how broadly the copyright now extends. So the fact that copyright law controls derivative works the way it does, meaning works based on original works. There's a very famous case recently where a woman named Alice Randall wrote a book called The Wind Done Gone, which is, I think, properly thought of as a sequel or a counter story to Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind. It's told from the perspective, Alice Randall's book is told from the perspective of the African slave. And it's critical, obviously, of the very bucolic and pleasant picture of Southern life that Margaret Mitchell's book tells. Now, I think Alice Randall's book, whether you like the book as a literary text or not, is an extremely important work to help us get a better picture of Southern life at in the antebellum and Civil War period. But copyright law, because of the perpetual extension of the term of copyrights, was used to stop Alice Randall from publishing her book. She had to go to two federal courts and defend the right to publish her book because the owners of the Margaret Mitchell copyright said, this is a sequel and we have the right to control who gets to tell the story in the future and we don't like your story, so you can't publish it.
So is that a turning point case then?
Well, it could have been. The actual ultimate decision wasn't as dramatic as some people had hoped. But I think it is a turning point case in getting people to see how copyright can extend too far, right? With ordinary property, I ought to be able to control my property for it, for my whole life, and my children ought to be able to control it for the rest of their lives. I have no problem with that, with my car or with my house or whatever. But with intellectual property, the framers of our Constitution were right when they said the term of that control should be limited. And I think the limit should be much closer to their vision of when they said 14 years, I've said much more than that, but still, what I think it should be is closer to their vision than to the vision of people like Hillary Rosen and Jack Valenti.
There's a caller on line one from Urbana.
Hi, I had a question. I was on the web, and Microsoft was advertising Office XP for students. And I went and looked at the limitations, and they say you can buy this for your elementary school student, but parents aren't allowed to use the software except in the course of helping their student. It just seems kind of bizarre to me.
Yeah.
I don't know if, you know, people can't respect the copyright law if it's so completely, you know, out of the normal experience of use.
Yeah. Yeah, this is a problem. I don't really blame Microsoft as much as Microsoft's lawyers, because for some reason, legal education takes normal thinking people and changes them into these bizarre creatures who think about the world in ways nobody recognizes anymore, right? So there's a very funny story about this new technology called e-books that allows you to read books online. And if you look at Adobe's technology, which is a really great technology for facilitating this, it gives publishers the power to control, quote, permissions in the use of this book. So the permissions might include the ability to print out pages from the book or to copy text from the book into other programs. But one permission it includes is the permission to use a technology to read the book aloud, right? Now, it's my great embarrassment that when they released my book using the Adobe ebook, they banned the user from the right to read the book aloud, you know, having the computer read it aloud to the person. Why? Well, because lawyers in the publishing, Random House, imagined that there was some real important reason to stop people from using their computers to read this book aloud to them. When ordinary people, and here I feel, in the same way, ordinary people would say, this is crazy. What possible reason would you have to stop me from using the computer to read aloud to me? And the problem is just a clash of cultures. Lawyers think constantly, how do I maximize control? And the rest of the world thinks, just because you wrote the book or just because you sold me the book doesn't mean you get to control how I use it or what I do with it from now on. And I think what's got to happen is ordinary people have got to begin to wake up and say to our congressmen, this is crazy, and you've got to change the law that gives them this power, because they don't deserve to control how I teach my children to use Windows products or use Office products or to read people's books. That's not what the framers had in mind.
Your point about lawyers and law students is interesting, because we teach law students the law by using cases. They read a lot of text in law school. Do you think there's a better way to teach them so that they become more cognizant of these issues?
Well, you know, so I spend a lot of time teaching students, and I actually have a great respect for the way we teach students. I don't think it's as much the teaching. It's just the fact that when they get out of law school, there isn't a strong balance between the sorts of things that they can do. The reason why the laws are extremely restrictive and pro-copyright, and the reason the lawyers are very restrictive and pro-copyright, is that the people who hire them are typically copyright people who want to defend their rights as strongly as possible. Now, what's troubling is that our legal profession doesn't have a strong enough principle that says we should be insisting on balance in this type of regulation and not allow special interests to capture the vision of what copyright law was to be about. Because copyright law, properly understood, is, I think, this sounds weird, but is a beautiful thing, because its conception was and always should be balance. But it has been captured by people who don't care about the vision of copyright law as balance, but who care about maximizing their control and therefore their income by perpetually trying to extend their control into different and new technologies.
And we have time to take one more call, line 4 from Danville.
Hello.
Hi.
I was just idly listening and eating my lunch, but then he made a remark about how with some online books can't be read aloud. Now, I'm text challenged, and I'm looking at computers. But see, the software that I need with the voice, for the voice option, the one that I really want costs $1,200. But now, if they're putting in copyright laws where I can't use this, is this very prevalent?
Yeah, this is a great example, because the answer is yes. Many of these e-books prohibit you from using a technology to read the book aloud. If you buy software that makes it so, that tries to remove that restriction, that software is a criminal offense in the United States. Now, this is the point that many of us have been making for a long time. There's no legitimate interest that the publisher has to stop somebody who's purchased an e-book and who is visually disabled from using technology to enable that book to be read aloud. There's no legitimate interest, yet our laws passed by Congress in 1998 make it a crime to develop and distribute software that would make it so you can use your computer to read that book aloud to you when the copyright owner has said to the contrary. And that's the kind of extremism which is reigning in Washington, and there is not a sufficient political movement to resist. And this is the perfect example. I'm sorry lawyers have made it like this, but there's been a lot of money spent in Washington to make it happen just like this.
And in the last minute or so, do you think it is going to happen? Is there going to be a groundswell with stories like we just heard?
Well, sometimes I'm optimistic about it. Sometimes I think, if ordinary people learned enough about this, they could actually go out and do something. But the reality is ordinary people don't pay much attention to these issues. There's all the money in the world on the other side. Hollywood and the recording industry have movie stars to parade before Congress. People on the other side, these computer programmers, guys with ponytails, I have a lot of respect for, but the world out there generally doesn't seem to have much respect for them. So it's possible, but I think it's extremely unlikely, because we've become such an apathetic political culture that even when there are these outrageous laws benefiting certain interests against the public good, people don't do anything about it.
And unfortunately, on that note, we've run out of time. Stanford Law Professor Lawrence Lessig has been our guest. His new book, The Future of Ideas, The Fate of the Commons in a Connected World, is published by Random House. Thanks for being here, Professor Lessig.
Thank you.